Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Ruth Rentschler. I'm a professor of arts and cultural leadership at the University of South Australia.
Thanks so much for being here. It's lovely to meet you, as you said earlier, albeit virtually, and I appreciate your taking the time, Prof. Ruth, to do this. So my first question is to ask what's currently dynamizing, preoccupying, interesting you? What's happening for you?
Well, I guess I've got three things top of mind at the moment, and they're interlinked. The first one is diversity and inclusion, and that is an area that informs a lot of the research I do, but also teaching. And I just did a guest spot at the University of Melbourne talking about diversity and inclusion in arts marketing, what it is, why it's important for the arts. So that's close to my heart and close to home. The second thing is, it's part of diversity and inclusion, is about arts and disability, a project I've been working on with Dr. Boreham Lee at the University of South Australia on arts and disability across two countries in Australia and South Korea, was shortlisted at the awards, the Asia Pacific Arts Awards given out by Creative Australia, which is the national arts funding and advisory body for the federal government. Our project on arts and disability, both during and after the pandemic, how the artists managed it and the journeys that they've been going on. We are doing two screen productions as a part of that project. One is a documentary and the other is a film of a performance called Counterpoise, which was done between the disability arts organisation that we've been working with in Australia and the disability arts organisation we've been working with in South Korea. Mm-hmm. And the other partners that we've been working with, partners in, film editing, in organising, in translating, in composing music, especially for our productions, and so on and so forth. So we feel very proud having been shortlisted for that national award when our screen productions haven't been released yet, and we hope to release them through arts festivals nationally and internationally. And the third thing, which is kind of a bigger thing, is the discourses going on in the world about some of the awful things that are happening in places like Palestine and Israel, Russia and Ukraine, what that means for us as human beings and what it means for our society, our economy, our artists, our arts leaders, and so on and so forth.
Well, thank you so much for that list, which is both personal, it's personal, it's professional, and of course, it's also political. I wondered if I could, in terms of diversity and inclusion, that's become an enormously controversial issue, regrettably, in the United States, as you're probably aware, with the right trying to crack down and criminalize attempts to make for a more diverse set of university experiences and more diverse notions of excellence and to include greater numbers. And that's been led by the white right and the Asian right against principally African Americans and Latinos, Latinas. What are some of the issues in Australia, particularly in terms of the arts, but perhaps more broadly, that you've been addressing, I wonder?
Well, there is certainly a discourse locally in South Australia, in Adelaide, the city in which I live, where people of colour are talking it's almost a subtext, because Adelaide's a very polite, orderly and cohesive society, but they're talking about what forms of art and types of art what sorts of production should we be putting on? And should we be putting on things that are like of the high arts, like opera, that are now considered not appropriate, either because of the subject matter or because of the way people are treated or because of the way performers are dressed up as blackface or yellowface or whatever it might be. And there is quite a lot of anger about that. And that's close to home. What I've found on the world stage is that there is that argument is going on. And again, there's quite a lot of anger. I'm producing a book at the moment, an edited book with academics who are co-editing with me, one in Canada and the other in Italy. And there's quite a conversation going on about how can we make the arts generally more inclusive. So for the book that we are doing, which is on governance, leadership, and philanthropy in the arts, we've been careful to ensure that we tried very hard to bring in authors of chapters in that book who came from different parts of the arts, so that it's not just white old women like myself, that we've got people of different persuasions, of different views. I'm a management scholar. I sit in a business school, but we wanted to take people who had different views in the humanities or who came from Africa and were therefore going to look at governance and leadership from a Black African perspective or from a North American perspective, from the African diaspora who, started out life over there as slaves, but are now fighting for their positions to be considered equals in the arts management community. So that is a conversation that's becoming louder and more insistent, and it's related to the one that arts workers and artists are going through about who should perform on our stages.
As you can see, the podcast is making an inter staging an intervention at this point, which is perhaps partly because after our talk, Prof, he and I are going A to have a manicure pedicure for him, so that he can't do the kind of damage he's trying to do to me at the moment, and B, so that he can get his European Union passport. However, back to what you were saying, I was very struck yesterday by an interview I read with David Harewood, Black British actor, new president of the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, in which he was describing the racism he experienced when appearing on the British stage as Romeo, and how his attitude now is, if you're a white guy and you want to play Othello in blackface, go ahead, but good luck. You'll have a tough audience. We'll see how we go. And I thought that that captured beautifully the way in which these questions, at least it seems to me, are both textual and occupational. In other words, there is offence both at the level of representation on stage or on canvas or whatever, but also occupationally in terms of the opportunities people have. Disabled people wanting to play disabled people because for generations in acting, people who were not disabled did so. It's one small instance, but there are plenty, right, that I'm sure you know a lot about. And it seems to me as though there is this dual representativeness question, representation in texts, in culture, and representation in labor terms. Does that make sense to
Sorry,
you at
what was
all?
the second one? There was representation or representativeness in text. And what was the second one, Toby?
Occupationally or in labor terms,
Ah,
right? In other words, opportunities to do things. Questions about appropriateness or not of representation, per what you were describing with reference to some opera, but also who gets to sing the opera, write the opera, produce the opera, direct the opera, etc. Right?
That's right. That's right. And it's not just having people in sort of lower order positions. There is an argument that people who have always been deemed as others want to be in leadership roles. So whether it's the playing Rome, playing who what was it? Othello, I think you said, didn't you?
I
Whether it's
mentioned
playing
Romeo and
Othello.
Othello.
I beg your pardon, Romeo. And whether it's playing them, or whether it's the lead singer in the opera, or whether it's being the new CEO As I just saw in Melbourne, I just met the new CEO of Multicultural Arts Victoria, where I was on the board for 9 years, it's some years ago now, but there is the first woman of colour taking up that role. So that is the sort of change that we're seeing, and it means that we can't stand still. We have to keep moving forward with how we see the leadership in arts organisations, the representations on the stage, the screen, on the canvas, etc., as you were saying.
So at some point, Prof, I may need to go to the restroom to wash the wounds that a certain young
Oh.
man is generating. Sometimes he gets very jealous with
Oh, they do.
my discussions, and particularly with women and women who have hair color similar to his, which applies in your case.
Oh, does it? My, I don't think it's like his, but he may think that.
Well,
Well,
your color, the color of your coat and the color of your hair match his mix of vanilla and orange. And he does get jealous. Anyway, back to what you were saying, more importantly than my
I
juvenile.
want to say one thing about my pet dogs, because I have two pet
Oh,
dogs, and
please do.
I intentionally came to the University of the campus to do this podcast because I knew they would be a nuisance and they would be jealous that I wasn't paying them attention.
Attention.
They get jealous of each other and jealous of me and jealous of me with my partner when we don't talk to them. So I thought I would make sure that I didn't have
Oh,
that, but
you made a trip to the
I
city.
could have stayed at home and enjoyed the little interplay that we're
My
all having.
problem, my difficulty, Prof, is twofold. I don't have an office where I work. I don't have anywhere that I can record. And he can open all the doors in my apartment because they're sliding doors. So there's no need of opposed thumbs. So
So just
I
the two
thank you for going to
intelligent.
all that trouble of going to school to record. And I apologize for not being able to offer something equivalent. Darling, please
That's
stop
all
me.
right.
Anyway, back to what we were saying.
Yes.
Is this tendency towards greater diversity and inclusion understood in Australia largely as a process of democratization and excellence, as I would see it? Or is it very controversial, as it is with the crazed right in many countries?
I don't think it's as controversial here as it is in what you were calling the crazed right in some developed countries. Australia's had a more cohesive society than has been the case with some multicultural societies. So we are multicultural. 50% of people are born overseas or have one or more parents born overseas. And that just shifted from 49% to 50 or 51% in the last national census. So we have an enormous number of people now from countries other than the UK, which has always been, our standard stock, foundational stock, if you like, of the people here. But now we have as many Chinese and Indians. I think the Indians have overtaken the Chinese as our main migrant group since the pandemic, because China was closed down for much longer than some other countries, and therefore they couldn't come here as much as they had before the pandemic. But yes, I've just come back from Sydney because I live in Adelaide, and Sydney is so multicultural. It's a completely fusion city now. The food has changed. When I grew up, it was just roast chicken or roast beef and potatoes and peas. That's what we got every night, more or less. And there was nothing of the food excitement that you get in sort of major world cities like Sydney and Melbourne now. They're completely different. When I go to the National Gallery of Victoria, which is run by an extraordinary director, Tony Elwood, I can't believe how diverse it is when you walk in there. And again, it was only 20, 30 years ago, I'd walk in there and everybody looked like me. So it's changed extraordinarily. And that's because of specific programs that have been put on to make sure it changes, changing the staff, changing the programs, changing the marketing, all those themes that help you reach different audiences.
Prof, one of the words you used earlier was marketing, arts marketing in particular was a term. And I'm conscious that in some of your work, you've written about the sense that there is a bit of distaste among many people involved in the arts or cultural policy for the idea of marketing because it is seen as associated with mammon and capitalism and rather unseemly. I wonder if you could talk about that tendency and whether you see it diminishing, remaining stable, or increasing, that distaste for marketing. And also tell us about the importance of arts marketing from your perspective.
Well, certainly, arts marketing has been a dirty word, and it is still a dirty word among the artistic fraternity. Not as much, I believe, as it used to be 20 to 30 years ago. And that's occurred, that shift has occurred where it's become more acceptable as the arts have become professionalized. They've become democratized. So, years ago, the arts were run by volunteer groups. They were paid little. They weren't educated or trained. They just hopped into positions. Often, if you were an arts manager or an arts leader of another type, it was because people felt you were a failed artist. I've always argued that a good arts leader can create many more jobs for artists. And I have seen that that can be the case. And functional roles have come into play as arts organisations have become more professional. So in the 1970s, in the National Gallery of Victoria, which I was talking about a few moments ago, one of the big state galleries in Australia, there were no arts marketers. What they had from about the end of the 1970s was a publicist, a very lowly paid, low level in the organisation, so not strategic at all. But now they have a whole suite of people reporting to the director. And so there's a director of marketing, and they've separated the functions of marketing and philanthropy. So they've got another new function there, raising money through things other than ticket sales, and they've got other sorts of ways of raising money through sponsorship, with companies and so on. And these things have occurred over the last 30 to 50 years, in parallel with what's gone on in the UK, the US. Europe's worked at a slightly different pace, but it's happening there. And it's changed the way people respond to these things. But that doesn't mean that artists still don't like that. I've still met artists, and I mean like artistic directors, who think having an arts marketer or a marketing director is taking money away from the artists. But if you're bringing in bigger audiences, it's bringing in more money into the organization, and that means that you're going to have more jobs for artists because that dirty word money is what pays for the artists, and artists should be paid. And if we can employ more artists on the stage, more exhibitions of artists in art galleries and so forth, and arts marketers can help us do that, then it's a good thing.
Prof, people like me on the loony left are very worried about these tendencies. Even as we can see their political economic benefit. And we're worried about them in ways that are cliched and you are all too familiar with. One, people like me think this is making more and more and more and more and more and more and more administrators, surveillance or accountability, depending on your point of view. And two, it's making into industries things that, yes, employ people, but should have elements that are, in a sense, purely aesthetic or whatever. And as I say, you've mounted extremely good arguments against loony leftism of my kind and of the kind you're saying a lot of artists have. Do you see any merit in our concerns, or is it just the loony left being ludicrous?
Of course, I see many merits in them. I was going to be an artist myself, a painter, but I decided that I'm on the cusp of introversion and extroversion, and I decided I was too extroverted to be in a studio all day by myself,
and
I would go mad. And I mean, there is a link between art and creativity and madness. So I did art history and Germanic studies instead and went to university rather than art school. And I guess I put my creativity now into, you know, writing papers, but also being a producer of these two screen productions that I'm doing with my colleague, Dr. Borum Lee, and being the chair of the board of, at the moment, Australian Dance Theatre, and I've chaired other boards in the arts and been on other arts boards. And I do undertake those roles as a board chair in a professional way. I look at it as a leadership role, but I nurture and develop the people who come into those organisations, particularly the executive director and artistic director, not always personally, but personally as well, but, you know, ensure they go on leadership programs so that they can develop their skills and that will make them a great artistic director or executive director for the future. But I harbour those same little views that you do, but I have to justify my position every day in the business school. Why am I studying artists? Well, I'm studying them because artists are often entrepreneurs, you know, whether it's the big names like Andy Warhol or Salvador Dali, or, you know, someone who's not so well known that I met on the flight coming back from Sydney to Adelaide this morning. There are others who you might say are on the loony left with you who don't even like cultural entrepreneurship or arts entrepreneurship. But how can I justify in my faculty that I'm studying or researching artists? And I have to find ways to do that, because really I'm always a square peg in a round hole. Where do I fit? Management in the context of the arts, but I could fit in an arts faculty. That's where I came from. And I never regret doing what I did, you know, studying English literature and Germanic studies. And we did not just the language, but the sculptors and the poets, and, you know, it speaks to the soul. And the arts speak to the soul. And I'm never happier than when I'm wandering around an art museum, which has perhaps, one might say, no practical worth, but it's so important for the soul of our country. And I have an economist friend from China who works at the same university with me, and his parents were both artists, but were terrifically scarred, even though they survived in the Cultural Revolution in China back in the 70s. And they said to their children, don't be an artist, it's too dangerous. So he became an economist. But he's also published on how arts leaders in China may be the way to save the soul of China. So he delves into those things, even as an economist. So sometimes I suppose we disguise who we really are, put on those magic cloaks and appear in a different guise for a variety of reasons.
No, I appreciate your frankness and the gentility and beauty of your answer. One of the terms that seems to be very popular in Australia, as it is in many countries, including China, is creative industries. This is a term you've not used so far. You've talked about creativity and so on.
Yes.
And I was just looking up the other day, because I've been asked to give a presentation on creative industries, Richard Florida's current speaking fee, and it's increased for an hour from between $50,000 to $70,000, which I would quite like as a salary for a year. I'd be very happy with $50,000. As a year's income. So it's clearly been quite lucrative for some people. I'm not sure how many artists are making $70,000 a year, let alone an hour. What's your take on this discourse of creative industries? Because the term you've been using is arts management, arts funding, arts policy.
Well, yes, I do. You know, if I'm writing a paper, I'll quite often position it in the creative industries. I am old enough to remember when there was no industry, it wasn't considered an industry. And the argument then was that because we weren't considered part of an industry, we weren't counted. And if you didn't count, if you weren't counted, you didn't matter. So in those old days, if you were a potter crafting the clay at her wheel, you could only, in the census, be counted as a bricklayer because they worked with clay. So there was this movement that went on by people in the arts, as it was then called, to have themselves classified as important so that they could be counted in things. And that took a long time and a lot of work across a number of countries, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, and so on and so forth. And so that was the start, and then we did it under the Labor government here of Bob Hawke and then Paul Keating, and those ideas were picked up in the UK as Blair wanted to get into government, and they changed things and started to ensure that people saw the arts, whether they were high, low, community arts, multicultural arts or whatever, in a different light. And Australia, of course, was, when I grew up, a fairly boring place. And most of the artists just went to the UK more than anywhere else to try and get a living there. And people like Barry Humphries and later Kylie Minogue and all sorts of people, later still those went to America, like some of our actresses and country musicians and so on and so forth, Nicole Kidman and her husband, they found fame and fortune overseas. Now you can make a career in the arts and creative industries or the cultural and creative industries or whatever you want to call them in Australia. And some of them make their careers here and some of them go abroad. So it has changed things, and now people are looking at it again and wanting change again. And there's the anti-creative industries movement that's come out in some of the books that have recently been published, like the one that's just come out by Justin O'Connor on the arts is not an industry. I can see it from two sides, and I've got a long memory and I remember where we came from, and it wasn't all bad. But as you said, Richard Florida has made a great deal of money out of his very clever book, and it was very timely for when it came out in the early 21st century. But we've moved on. We're looking at other things in other ways. Florida came out here to Adelaide and gave some very sound advice as how we could make Adelaide a creative city. They implemented all of the recommendations, and it did enrich Adelaide. It brought in more tourists because Adelaide was a fairly small, sleepy town. We've now got about 1.3 million. But post-COVID, we're doing very, very well. There's a lot of people wanting to come and live in a smaller place that they see as safer. It's got better quality of life, lower cost of housing. I guess we just have to make sure we don't destroy it and become another megalopolis or something.
Prof, one of your co-authored pieces from 3 or 4 years ago is about what the arts were like, which you've already touched on, in Australia prior to the Kool-Aid slash miracle of the invention of the creative industries. And this is where you and a colleague look at annual reports of arts funding nationally in Australia over a quarter of a century. I wonder if you could take us back to that time, I guess a time when you were growing up, when you were in college and
yes,
perhaps becoming an academic, in terms of that article, but also more generally.
Yes. Well, look, I started looking at annual reports when I first did my PhD, you know, back in the last century, the 20th century. And I found that they were fonts of all sorts of information, and they were quirky, unlike corporate reports, because they did professionalize and corporatize later than some of the happened in business. And I read the annual reports of the Art Gallery, Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory. It was just fascinating what I found there and how quirky they were. And then more recently, and I've read lots of other annual reports, but then more recently, I read the annual reports of the Creative Australia, as it's now called. It was the Australia Council for the Arts, and started to look at the pictures in them. And I thought, there's an argument here historically to look at how First Nations people in Australia, we call them Aborigines in South Australia, but they're called different things in different states of Australia, how they were represented in those annual reports. And in many ways, the Australia Council for the Arts was unbelievably forward-thinking in what they did. Way back in 1975, they appointed only one, but one Aboriginal to the council, the board of the Australia Council for the Arts. I mean, that was just an extraordinary thing to do. And they were creating an Aboriginal arts industry, let me call it that, but an Aboriginal arts, performing arts, visual arts, etc. So they were taking it from rock painting and sand pictures and things like that, and painting on the body, and developing a high art of Aboriginal art. And it started with one man working in the outback of Australia saying, how could I change the perception of Aboriginal people in Australia? If people saw their art and thought it was valued, it might make those Aboriginal people be more valued themselves. And it came from that kernel of an idea. So I started looking at some of these exquisite images. They were better than any other images in those annual reports. And the annual reports were heavy and rich with those images. At the same time, coming out of a business school, I suppose, I thought, I'll look at where the money goes. And it was just a chance thing. And I thought, well, let's see. They were, again, so revealing in where they showed me where the money all went, to which art forms. And the poor old Aboriginal people, they never got above 7 to 10% of the money, even though often the cover would be an Aboriginal artwork on the cover, and they had all these beautiful images in the annual reports, but they got this miserly amount of money. All the money went to the big traditional European art forms, opera. Today, Opera Australia gets 118 million around every year. Our little Australian dance theatre, contemporary dance, gets about 400,000. So there's a big difference, and the innovation often comes from the small to medium sector, and that's where your next lot of artists, of leaders, often come from. So there seemed to me to be an inequity in this. So I analysed annual reports and the financials, did some graphs, and it seemed to me that when I looked at, the number of images, the quality of the images, the types of images, maybe there was a sort of misappropriation of things going on. I'm sure no one at the Australia Council saw themselves as doing that, and they are horrified to think that it might be looked at that way retrospectively. And is that even fair when they were developing Aboriginal arts and giving people jobs in the Aboriginal community and making them feel proud of what they do and making sure they had an income from their art? So it's a very vexed question. And I feel sad that I revealed that in a way, because of all the good things the Australia Council has done for the Aboriginal community. But there it was in black and white and colour. That's what happened. And I think that because it shows the value of being in a business school, sometimes that you look at things differently. No one had ever done that before, perhaps because in the arts, nobody really looked at the figures the way we do in business schools. And I would like to think that it means the Aboriginal artists are going to get more money. And I think they are. They've changed the way they do funding at the now called Creative Australia, the former Australia Council. And I like to think that some of that's come from the work I've done, because They wanted to do the right thing, but you know, in the end, I work in a bureaucracy in a university. The Australia Council was a bureaucracy. They'd given this much money. It's hard to change. But now we've got a new organisation in Creative Australia. There's a big opportunity to change in all sorts of ways. They're doing things differently.
Yes, when you mentioned that early history of the recognition and propulsion and control and marketing of Indigenous art, I think about Fred Meyer's work going back.
Yes.
That's been really interesting and significant, I think. Prof, I want to take you back to a much earlier article that you did nearly 20 years ago. So this, given that you're so prolific, may be a stretch in terms of memory, but it may not in terms of the significance of the content. And this is a piece, again, I think co-authored, about pricing issues for museums. Does that ring a bell?
It does.
Yeah.
I did it with one, a young woman who became a PhD student. She did a brilliant PhD, and she now works at the University of Melbourne. And yes, we did look at pricing of museums. Pricing of museums, it's quite interesting because should we charge for entry or should we not? In the Anglo sphere, we think it should be free to come into a gallery or museum. But the French have a completely different view. And it wasn't until I started working with a professor of arts management in France at the then called Bordeaux Business School, now called Kedge, that I realised they thought everybody should pay because most of them were tourists and that brought money into the French economy. And that's really interesting because so much of what France has done has got a kind of socialist view thrust to it. But they are quite pragmatic when it comes to reefing the money off the tourists, whereas the UK way and the Australian way of thinking about it is we should let everybody in for free. And a lot of our galleries and museums here are free. You do pay for blockbuster exhibitions and things like that. And sometimes, like at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, they have a big Perspex box where they have lots of notes in it to encourage you to give. And they say they get a lot more that way than charging you a small amount for an entry fee. And it is about equity, as we see it, you know, inclusion, and letting everybody in, however rich or poor they might be. So that I mean, yes, we were looking at pricing because of
yes, that is very interesting. And here in Spain, people pay to go to museums by and large. But if you're a teacher of any kind anywhere in the world, or an artist, and you can prove that, which often is complicated, as various tax regimes will show, then you don't pay. In India, I don't know if this is still the case, but when I was last there, you paid more. Entry was free for Indian nationals and people of Indian origin, and it wasn't for foreigners. So there, as you say, there is a long tradition of this, and it is particularly interesting, I think. I wanted to ask you one last question, if I may, Prof, and then throw to you to add anything you wish to what we've been talking about, because, as I said, you have such a rich and enormous body of work that we've only touched on some aspects. Actually, sorry, there are two questions I'd like to pose to you and then throw to you. The first is to ask you about whether or not museum attendance, opera attendance, dance attendance seems to have been democratized over the last, say, 20 or 30 years. I mean, to give an example, in New York, every now and then there are attempts to popularize places like the Met or MoMA, Museum of Modern Art, by putting on blockbuster shows that are very much about the popular. And what tends to happen is, if it's an exhibition about Harley Davidson, then bikers come to see that, but they never come again.
Yes, and they've done that at the Powerhouse Museum. They had a fabulous exhibition of tattooing, and that you could get your tattoo on the front doorstep before you came in. And it attracted a huge new audience. So yes and no is the answer. So places like the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney have been very clever at attracting diverse audiences. Opera, or Opera Australia is the company, for example, the great big one that, mostly performs in Opera Australia. They have their opera audiences for whether it's the traditional operas that Mozart or whatever, and people are much older than me. I feel very young when I go to the opera. But they also do, at the moment, they're doing West Side Story, which clearly attracts a different audience. So it has happened by changing the product that they offer to the public. And it has happened in the way they put on different types of exhibitions. And it has happened where you get clever directors like Tony Elwood at the National Gallery of Victoria, who's just completely democratized and, diversified the audience for that gallery. But I go to galleries where it's happened only partially, and you still see predominantly white, older, usually female visitors to museums and galleries or whatever. And of course, there's some difference across those art forms. Australian Dance Theatre, where I'm the chair at the moment, we have a First Nations artistic director, so he's putting on work that appeals to different segments. So we quite often get a more traditional segment alongside younger groups of people, First Nations people, and things like that. And we've quite deliberately gone out to change the composition of our audience. The museums have always attracted a more diverse audience than galleries, and particularly contemporary art galleries, which have been much more or much less diverse. But these days, contemporary art's become very popular. And I went to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney, and it was a very, very different audience from what you would have seen 20, 30 years ago. Much younger, people pushing children in strollers and so forth, different nationalities, ethnicities. Really, really interesting. And I think it's to do with some shift that's occurred where, in Australia at least, people don't want antiques in their homes. They don't want the old, the dark wood. They want everything to be white, and they want contemporary art to go with it. So there's been some shift in taste that's occurred, and that's affected attendance at galleries, and some sorts of galleries in particular. There has been big change. I think there's been big change, particularly over 50 years.
And my last question for you, Prof, and then as I say, I'll throw it to you to add anything you may wish, is about disability, which is one of the recurring
Yes.
themes in your work and is such a crucial issue in terms of democracy, inclusiveness, diversity. And we've seen an enormous change in this over the last 40 years in particular. But gigantic changes are still needed. I wonder if you could talk to us a bit about your research in that area.
Yes. Well, I've recently joined the DDEF community myself, so I've got a hearing aid in one ear, which I'm testing out, and I will probably get one in the other. And it's been a very interesting experience. I had no understanding that your brain has to get used to it and all these sorts of things. So, and I do find I miss a lot of things now. One-on-one, it's fine, but in a sort of party environment, I find it much more difficult to hear what's going on. So there's a personal thing there that's more recent. And then everybody, I think, in your family somewhere has somebody with some sort of disability. My partner now has a mobility scooter, and he's much deafer than I am. So you see the world differently, and our local cinema has been marvelous to him. They're so kind and so thoughtful. So things are changing, And there is a long way to go, and we are looking at people differently who participate in the arts as artists, as audiences, and in other ways as academics or whatever. But just because somebody has an intellectual disability or a mental health disability doesn't mean they're stupid. You know, even people randomly sort of think that if you've got an intellectual disability, you can't make your own decisions. Or if you've got a speech impediment, it means that you're stupid. And that's been one of the biggest learnings for me. There are people who have all sorts of abilities, and we need to learn to work with what people can do rather than focusing on what they can't do. And what they can do can bring them great richness as much as it can bring us great satisfaction that we have become more inclusive in the way we do things and more understanding. I was talking with one of the leaders at one of the visual arts, disability visual arts organisations in Melbourne a little while ago, and she talked to me about one of their artists who is non-verbal, and that his art is so good that he now doesn't have a disability pension. He can live off selling his art. And they have learned to communicate with him in different ways. So they present things to him, pin them on a notice board so that he's got choices and he can choose what he can put in his artwork and so on and so forth. So learning to communicate with people who can't do it by speech is something, again, that we have to learn different ways of working, whether it's artistic work or leadership work or a combination of both, and learning to be more tolerant of others who have different abilities. So that one of my participants in one study said she hopes the word disability just moves out of the lexicon, that we don't use it anymore.
One of the expressions that's used a lot in the US, I don't know if it's used in Australia, is the temporarily able-bodied.
Interesting. Yes, that's a good,
And the acronym is
yes.
TAB, and it's used often in order to not make the so-called disabled other, but to make the normal other in the sense of it being a conjunctural status, not one that will be forever, even if it is currently enjoyed. Right.
Yes, I
So
really like that.
it is an interesting one, isn't it? I think it's very confronting and challenging and interesting. So, Prof. Ruth, I wonder if I can invite you now to bring things to a conclusion by adding to what we've discussed, if there's anything you wish to do that with. And it might be touching on topics we've already mentioned, or it might be something we haven't.
The most important thing that I've learned through my research is that you learn as much from other people as you give, and that by working with people of all abilities in different parts of society, whether it's the arts or social nonprofits or whatever it might be, every day you learn something new. And that makes you feel humble, and that right to the end, I think that you could go on learning every day. That would be my final observation.
Thank you so much, Professor Ruth Rentschler. It's been wonderful getting to know you a little bit. I deeply admire your work, and today's been tremendous.